All right. So this is our last class on Active Hope, which we're studying this book, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone. And this was a this whole series was a bit of an experiment for me as a Zen teacher. This book isn't explicitly Buddhist. For me, this has been a very relevant part of my life and practice my whole life. I mean, I studied to be a wildlife biologist so that I could save the planet, and then I decided that wasn't going to save the planet fast enough, and actually the most effective thing I had seen was Zen practice, so I decided to become a monk instead. But, you know, it was all kind of toward this concern for the state of the world, and I personally have found this book to be one of the most helpful things for me in terms of how to frame a world in suffering and how to respond to it and how to maintain some kind of positive attitude. And I'm hoping that some of you who have read it and now been exposed to it through this class have found it somewhat helpful as well. You know, I guess I figure we're Buddhists and we take the Bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. I mean, that's not the entire Bodhisattva vow, but that's a very central part, is that a Bodhisattva works for their own liberation, but they do not just retire off into bliss, even though theoretically they could, like, you know, with spiritual achievement, they could just, you know, go off into nirvana, but they don't. They stay engaged in the world in order to free all other beings. The idea being that we're all in this together. So I figured Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone define an activist. So they said we need to broaden our definition of what an activist is. And they say anyone who is active for a purpose bigger than personal gain. So that's pretty broad. So I figured, to me, that pretty much means that when we become a Buddhist and take the Bodhisattva vow, we're vowing to be an activist. Not in the ordinary sense of the term, but in the sense of being active for a purpose bigger than personal gain. Experimental for me in the sense that I'm not sure how many people found it directly relevant or whatever. I've tried to tie it back to Buddhist teachings, but it's part of what we're going to do tonight is do a little bit of a sharing and debrief on just kind of where are we now and how useful was this to us? What lessons are we taking away? But very briefly, I want to cover the last two chapters of the book, which are maintaining energy and enthusiasm and strengthened by uncertainty. So this is all about cultivating active hope and finding a way to be this kind of activist without... So active hope is really focusing on our hope for the world, not focusing on what we're hopeful will turn out, because that's based on, like, how likely is it that we're going to succeed? How likely is it that justice will be had, which can be pretty not encouraging at times when we're, you know, looking out in the world and trying to feel optimistic. That is can be very overwhelming. So this is about making a practice of focusing on what we hope for the world, on our own activity for a purpose bigger than personal gain, and being centered in that. In a way, it's like, it doesn't matter. We hope for a good outcome, but it doesn't matter what happens. It matters what we're going to do with our life. So this book is meant about that. So obviously, maintaining energy and enthusiasm is important. they list five different things that are very important for that. Recognizing enthusiasm as a valuable renewable resource. Broadening our definition of activism. Following the inner compass of our deep gladness. Redefining what it means to have a good life. And seeing success with new eyes and savoring it. So very briefly, I'm going to end with enthusiasm because then we'll do a brief exercise. But in terms of broadening our definition of activism, not only is it, you know, active for a purpose bigger than personal gain, but one of the things that they talk about is telling a new story about what's happening. There's three stories: business as usual, the great unraveling, it's all coming apart, we're all gonna die, and then the great turning, which is like you're not letting either of those stories have the final word, but focusing on this could be a transformative time for humankind, and actually a lot of good could come of it now that we're motivated to do something, and so we could really make a change. So in those efforts, and if we're trying to assist with the great turning, there's three different kinds of actions that they talk about. Holding actions, which are trying to stop or mitigate the harm that is being done. That's kind of often what we think of as activism, right? But then also life-sustaining systems and practices. So exploring or supporting alternative ways to do things that aren't so harmful. And then the third is a shift in consciousness. So that really, you know, opens things up. That's like education and art and writing and, you know, I don't know. It's like could include a lot of different kinds of activities that we might be doing on behalf of this great turning. Like I said, taking part in the great turning doesn't have to mean suddenly changing jobs or giving up other interests. Rather, it means applying our skills, experience, networks, enthusiasm, and temperament to the healing of our world. So then in terms of following the inner compass of our deep gladness, it says we are more effective when acting from our strengths and enthusiasm. That is where the great turning can happen through us most powerfully. This is a big shift away from the idea that there is one right way forward that we should all follow. Rather, it suggests that each of us needs to find our place of greatest fit. Author and minister Frederick Buchner describes this as, quote, our deep gladness and the world's deep need meet, end quote. When we find this convergence, the great turning works through us in a way uniquely ours. And then redefining what it means to have a good life. Obviously, we have cultural messages about what a good life is, fame, success, power, money, etc. But they quote from a book, "The best moments usually occur when a person's body or mind is stretched to its limits in a voluntary effort to accomplish something difficult and worthwhile." So they find when they have people reflect on their lives, on like the happiest times, that often involves something like that. So they tell the story in this section of the example of John Robbins. His father and uncle created Baskin and Robbins, so he was going to be heir to this giant, the largest ice cream business in history, being groomed to be the next CEO. But I guess they had a advertising that said, "We make people happy." And he just didn't quite ring true. So at some point he just gave it all up, and he and his wife like went and lived off the grid somewhere for a decade. And
became one of the most influential vegans ever.
Yes, yes, because then he wrote Diet for a New America, which he explores the links between food, health, and our environment. And then it was a million bestseller, but he still just continued to live the same lifestyle that he had, even though he made money from the book. So he describes it, the object of the game is to see how much you can lower your spending while raising your quality of life. I think that's really fascinating. And they say in here, if everyone lived as the average North American or European does, we'd need 3 to 5 planets like Earth to supply the resources and cope with the rubbish. Because the link between happiness and consumerism has been so powerfully woven into our culture, the idea of giving up or cutting back is usually seen as grim and threatening. Yet as John points out, the real losses come from consumerism. Bit by bit, we are losing our world. We are losing the forests, the fish, the bees. We are wiping out whole species. We are losing the richness of community and much of what makes life meaningful. We are now on the brink of losing the biological support systems we need to survive. Through the game of learning to live well with less, we stand to gain. We stand to increase our resilience at a time of financial uncertainty, reducing the anxiety over how we'll manage when money is short or loses its value. This game played well leads to happier, more fulfilling lives. And then seeing success with new eyes. We experience success when we reach a goal that is significant to us. But what if our goal is the elimination of poverty or the transition to a low-carbon economy? If the change we want doesn't happen in our lifetime, does that mean we will never experience success? For the encouraging boost we get when we know we're moving forward, we need to find markers of progress we can spot more easily and often. What helps here is making the distinction between eventual goals and intermediate ones. So they recommend, and I'm sure this is, you know, present in many guides to how to be efficient in your life, but you know, this is the ultimate goal. And you know, what's something that you might do to get there, and what's something you might do to get there, and backtracking until there's, you know, some actual actionable things that you can do. And then recognizing, like, so, you know, celebrating those successes, which I think probably many of us fail to do in our lives, because we have an idea of what we want to have happen, but we don't recognize the things that we're actually achieving from day to day. So then finally, that recognizing enthusiasm as a renewable resource. And I just thought the most effective way to get at this, what they mean by this, was just to pair off and with somebody you don't know so well. Can't pair off. Pair off, and then these questions are just, you're supposed to complete these sentences. Things that drain, demoralize, or exhaust me include... What nourishes and energizes me is the times I'm most enthusiastic are when. So, I don't know that there will be enough for everybody, certainly every other person. And so just, you know, pair off with somebody you don't know anyone well. I know. know some people like can't stand being broken up into small groups, and they're like, but it is really fun to like look around the room and see people like animatedly getting to know one another. So, and very briefly, strengthened by uncertainty is the last chapter. And as Buddhists, I think a lot of our practice is aimed toward getting us comfortable with don't know mind and, you know, comfortable with not knowing. But they make some good points about uncertainty, which they made an analogy. I guess Chris Johnstone has done some work with people with addictions. And he says, you know, at the outset of a program, you know, he said, you know, some people are going to just, you know, sink back into their addictions. Some people are really going to kick it and turn their life around. And he said at the beginning, you can't tell who's who. You can't tell which. And he said some people are convinced that they're going to make it. And he said that it can actually be a shortcoming, because then it actually can be some complacency and some shock when things are difficult. Some people are convinced that they're not going to make it. And then, you know, they're kind of doomed from the beginning. But he said it's the people who have that sense of uncertainty. I don't know. I don't know if I'm, you know, how this is going to go, that actually, you know, have the best outcomes. So obviously, in terms of, you know, the climate change and ecological crisis and other problems facing us, you know, that kind of optimistic complacency, we can just go, oh, you know, well, we'll figure it out and it'll all get this worked out. And then that's kind of not motivating either. Or you can just be like, we're all just going to die. And so then there's that pessimism of like, well, then there's nothing we can do. So really that we don't know. And that's really the truth, is we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. And also they point out that uncertainty keeps us in the present. Like you don't know what's going to happen next, so you're paying attention to what's happening. And also can bring a sense of mystery and adventure. Especially in, you know, times in your life where like things have really shifted and you really don't know what's going to happen next. And it's kind of an open sense of openness about that. And then, before we do our last exercise, just wanted to read the closing chapter. Say, we live at a time when the living body of our earth is under attack, and when the attacker is not an alien force, but our own industrial growth society. At the same time, an extraordinary recovery process is underway, a vital creative response we call the Great Turning. What helps us face the mess we're in is the knowledge that each of us has something significant to offer, a contribution to make. In rising to the challenge of playing our best role, we discover something precious that both encircles our lives and adds to the healing of our world. An oyster, in response to trauma, grows a pearl. We grow and offer our gift of hope, active hope. So, I wanted to divide into two groups this time, and each group is going to have a different question, because in one group, I want, so you go to whichever group you feel the most resonance with. And it doesn't mean you have to, like, commit, like, that is saying your position forever, but just whichever you feel the most resonance with at the moment. So in one, I want to find a new way to take action in the world, to contribute to the Great Turning. So the Great Turning is the emergence of new and creative human responses, participating in the epical transition from an industrial society committed to economic growth to a life-sustaining society committed to the healing and recovery of our world. So that kind of broad sense of activism. So in you know, part of what the reason that I did this course was for people who really did feel like they wanted to do something more in response. Not that any of us have a whole lot of spare time and energy, but still just kind of a sense that I want to find a new way to respond. I want to find something new to do, or something like that. And that this was really a way to come together and do that and find a way forward. So I want to kind of honor that. The other group, I'm not interested in or able to commit to exploring a new way to respond at this time. And this, as I've tried to say repeatedly in the class, I mean, this can be for many reasons. Your life is filled to capacity. You already have things that you do in your life as a activist in a way of service or whatever. You know, you have health issues, you have a family, you have whatever. There's many reasons why you might not be, you know, gearing up to, you know, look for something new. So you don't need to explain that. But the questions for that group, thinking just given that a great many people and beings are already suffering the effects of the climate and ecological crisis and many other crises, and that these problems may get much worse within our lifetimes, how do you face, like the subtitle of this book, how do you face the mess we're in without going crazy? And is there anything, you know, if you've read this book or if you've been here for a number of these classes, is there anything from these classes that you're taking away in terms of a useful you know, practice or a useful way of thinking about things? But it doesn't have to be limited to that book. It could be something else that you've come up with yourself. And what aspects of your Buddhist practice help you avoid despair, depression, numbing out, etc.
Can you read the questions for the first group again?
Yeah, and I will also give like a copy of the questions to each group so you can revisit what you're doing. So the first group I'm imagining, it's like, again, you don't have to commit to anything, but having a sense of resonance with, I want to find a new way to take action in the world to contribute to the great turning. If perhaps you, I don't know if it's quite right to say, I don't feel like I'm doing enough, but I think that kind of resonates with some of us. Even though once we start to think, how could we add anything to our lives? I don't know, but you know, still a desire that somehow we can help. There's part of us that's really longing to find a way to help in a way that we aren't already. So that's what I'm kind of picturing for the first group. And the first group, you know, their questions. I didn't get to their questions. What is next for each person in the who's feeling that way? What are you going to do? I mean, this whole book was about going forth. So there's these different stages of coming from gratitude, honoring our grief, seeing with new eyes, and going forth. So the whole argument of this book is finding something to do. So I wanted to honor that by inviting those who are drawn in that direction to talk about what might we do. Either it may be as individuals, maybe as a group, which Drew has actually expressed interest in forming. We don't know what, right? And I thought maybe that some of that initial discussion could happen in this group of what could you do? What kind of group or discussion or something, some way of supporting one another to go forward. There's also been talk in the past about maybe our Sangha takes on a cause or some kind of service or something like that, but it doesn't have to be that. So those who want to explore that kind of, where do we go from here in terms of doing something? And then those who aren't feeling called to do something new, sharing a kind of debriefing on this class and, you know, how do we face the mess we're in without going crazy. So, I'd say, over there by Drew, I changed my mind. If you kind of want to talk about what could be next, if you're feeling the call to do something, and if you're kind of new to this whole discussion, just feel free to go, you know, whichever, and just kind of listen or check the same things out. And if you're really thinking, no, I'm not really going to add anything new, but, you know, then we'll discuss this. I mean, every day we're facing stuff in the news. If you watch the news, unless you somehow manage to completely avoid the news, which I find amazing, you wouldn't be able to go grocery shopping because then you couldn't see it. You know, you'd have to avoid all the magazines and the checkout lines. I mean, there's pretty much impossible to avoid all of it. So any of it you're getting is, you know, going to be disturbing at times. All right, and then over here, group two. So go ahead and just kind of pick up your chair and rearrange yourselves. We just have about 15 minutes left.
Water and carbon footprint of foods I eat. I've been trying to avoid beef and pork and go more for the
United States.
Different emissions of food.
So it's 9 o'clock. I hope that was useful. Feel free to keep chatting or leave. Up to you.